Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Beautiful March day. Today I welcome one of the most popular writers in the field of yoga and spirituality. Her book, Daughters of the Goddess, The Woman Saints of India, is a bestseller and has won awards. And she's written several other books, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hinduism, which you might have seen in one of your local bookstores. And she writes for many magazines on Hinduism and yoga practice. Her recently released book, Lost Masters, covers a little different ground. It's rediscovering the mysticism of the ancient Greek philosophers, but again, exploring the fascinating commonalities between the Greek philosophical tradition and Hindu spirituality, and also talks a little bit about some of the ways that we in the Western tradition have twisted some of the our understandings of the Greeks, made them into more rational, empirical folks than they were. They were more holistic, and we'll find out more about that. But it's a joy to welcome Linda Johnson to today's show. So welcome, Linda.
Paul, hey, thanks for having me on to talk about my favorite subject.
Good. Which is what?
Which is the ancient Greek philosophers. And, you know, just like everyone else on the planet, I used to think that the ancient Greeks were about as relevant to our lives today as bows and arrows. You know,
right.
But when I started researching the original Greek sources, I was astonished to find out how much the Greeks had in common with spiritual seekers today. You know, we're always told, you know, the Greeks were the founders of our modern Western system of scientific materialism, as you were just saying, Paul. But what they tell us about themselves is that they were intensely interested in spirituality. Many of them believed in karma and reincarnation. You know, a lot of them were vegetarian. You know, they meditated. They studied near-death experiences. They fought for animal rights. They tried to understand God and the nature of their own souls. You know, in antiquity, people thought of the Greek philosophers not as eccentric old men who wrote boring books that no one wants to read, you know, as we think of them today. You know, they thought of them as sages, as spiritual teachers.
Totally different. And also, you know, back at that time, there wasn't this great divide, was there, between spirituality on the one hand, or artistic endeavor, if you like, on the one hand, and then science and empirical understanding on the other. You know, there's this great gulf today. And I think only recently have we begun to span that gulf, right? The work that's been done in terms of holism and understanding that, you know, with quantum physics, we're explaining through science what the mystics have known for thousands of years. So there is that recognition. Aha, maybe we're actually talking about, you know, the same subject, looking at it from a different point of view. And the Greeks were fine with this, right? They could be extremely scientific, but also open to the numinous and the mysterious, the spiritual.
Correct. Now, I do want to be clear that they did have a very rational approach to this. You know, they were not sloppy thinkers. But they did not consider metaphysical subjects to be off limits, like a lot of scientific types do today.
So what is it that you think that, I think you have a chapter on it too, at the end of the book, discussing some of the reasons why we have this view of the Greeks. Part of it, I think, was Christianity, wasn't it, that did a disservice to that tradition. It modified it beyond recognition in some ways.
Well, you know, I was actually, I have a very, very strong Christian background myself. But as I was reading through numerous historical sources, there was a lot of parts of history I hadn't heard about that were really, really heartbreaking. There was a part of Christianity early on that was very, very zealous, shall we say. You know, when we hear about a small minority of Muslims now who are very, very fanatical, and we forget that Christianity went through that same stage. And so they were, and we always hear about the origins of Christianity from a Christian perspective. But as I'm reading the Greeks, you know, we're hearing about these libraries where the Greeks were preserving their ancient wisdom traditions and their scientific traditions. And Christian zealots would come and burn the libraries. And when pagans would run in to try to save the books, because, of course, they were all handwritten in those days, then the Christians would, in some cases, actually bar the pagans inside the libraries and burn them together with the books. I mean, it was really, really horrible. And then finally, when was it, like 529, something like that, Emperor Justinian closed the pagan universities to just really finish destroying these ancient wisdom traditions.
The irony is, of course, isn't it, that Islam, that was just coming on the scene at that time, you know, and beginning to spread out from Arabia all across North Africa and in some of the ancient places of learning, it actually preserved some of these teachings.
Paul, that was my next point.
For like 1,000 years, didn't they?
You're exactly right. It's so, like, right now we think of, we have this prejudice against Muslims as being, you know, less developed. We forget that back when our tradition, those of us who are Christian like me, was going around destroying the wisdom of the ancient cultures, it was the Muslims who preserved it. So we owe a tremendous debt to them. But it was around the time of the Renaissance that this material was rediscovered in Europe, and this actually is what sparked the European Renaissance. However, you know, we almost never hear about this material anymore. Now, scholars are fully aware of all this evidence of the ancient Greek spirituality, but they ignore it. They say it's, quote, Oriental contamination, unquote, you know, of pure rational Western thought. They find it embarrassing that many of the fathers of Western civilization were nowhere nearly as committed to materialism as academics are today. You know, the ancient Greeks were curious and open-minded. And when we search intelligently for a deeper understanding of our own spiritual nature, we are not betraying the Western tradition. We are just following in the footsteps of its founders.
It does make you want to read some more again. You know, I must admit, having read your book this week, it's like, oh, yeah, this is cool. You know, and I knew a lot of what was in the book. A lot of it I didn't. But we are familiar slightly with a general overview, if you've got any kind of education, general overview of the Greeks, you know, especially the famous ones.
Right.
But but it makes me want to go back to, you know, my old philosophy courses and everything, and take another look, because, like you said, they were taught, at least back in those days, in a very different way to what you're presenting. You know, you're presenting a much more, like we said earlier, holistic view, and you cover all the big names, don't you, from the Orphic tradition, Orpheus, all the way down through Pythagoras, Heraclitus, Empedocles, and then the big three, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, up to my favorite, Plotinus, you know.
God bless you, Paul. I'm a huge... Plotinus was the greatest of them all, in my opinion, also.
Yeah, and he influenced a lot of Christians, actually.
Right.
You know, so I remember at Unity Seminary, we studied Plotinus quite a bit because his Neoplatonic understanding, you know, I think influenced later writers and certainly influenced the thread that we call unity, you know, so that it's a very profound understanding, I think, and he took some of the more metaphysical ideas even deeper than Plato, if that could be said, you know, and opened them up in a more mystical, spiritual way. He sort of built on Plato, but yeah. So you take us all the way up to really, like you say, the destruction of this tradition. In about the 6th century of the Common Era. So let's talk about Orpheus. I'm a very big fan of Rilke, the poet, and of course he's written a whole sonnets to Orpheus, where he mines this great mythology and all the legends around Orpheus. But it is an archetypal myth, isn't it? And all the stories that surround that. You talk a lot about Dionysus in this regard, too. Tell us a little bit about Orpheus.
Well, Orpheus, he goes so far back in prehistory that we don't have a lot of information about him as a man. But we know that he taught the existence of karma. He taught the existence of reincarnation. He was a proponent of nonviolence. He was a vegetarian and encouraged vegetarianism. So these strains go back very, very far, perhaps to, you know, 800 BC or earlier, in the ancient world. Then by the time you get to Pythagoras, then we have a lot more information about him as a human being. Actually, let me just tell you a little bit about Pythagoras. He was the guy who invented the theorem that all of us learned in math class, you know, the Pythagorean theorem. But what we never hear is he actually founded a hugely successful spiritual community in Italy. And this is around like 500 BC. His followers meditated, they ate no meat, they drank no alcohol, they worked out every day, they practiced music therapy, and they tried to reach a state of enlightenment. And I'm reading all these very ancient Greek sources. You know, they tell us that Pythagoras spent decades studying with spiritual masters in Egypt, in Syria, in Persia. And according to one ancient authority, possibly even with the Hindu Brahmins. And, Paul, get this. You know, his first teacher was Thales. The very same Thales that we learned in grade school was the father of Western science. And it was Thales who encouraged him to go to Egypt, because Thales himself had studied with the priests there. It is a myth that the ancient Greeks were self-educated geniuses who came up with all their ideas by themselves. You know, many of them studied abroad. I actually took a course in Greek philosophy in college, and my professor, who was a Jesuit priest, would tell us, you know, read this part or this part or this part of Plato, but skip these other parts, because that's just the Oriental contamination. That's where, you know, the rationalism failed. So we're going to ignore that and don't even bother reading that. So it wasn't until some years ago when I went back and started reading the parts that my professor had told us to skip, that I discovered the incredible spiritual richness of the ancient Greek tradition. Let me tell you about Empedocles. He was the guy who we were told in grade school was the first to teach that matter is made of elements. So he had four elements. Empedocles was a doctor, but his main interest, according to the ancient sources, was, and the phrase is, curing souls. And so what did Empedocles advise his patients was critical to their health and well-being. So we read in the ancient sources, Empedocles told them to meditate. And here's what he said. He said, "You must plunge beneath your crowded thoughts and calmly contemplate higher realities with pure, focused attention. Then a state of tranquility will remain with you throughout your life. But if instead you direct your attention to the trivial things most people obsess about, the silly nonsense that dulls their minds, then all you'll have are physical objects that you'll just lose anyway." And Paul, if you don't mind, I just have to read one more quote from Empedocles. So here's a guy who is universally acknowledged by scientists today as one of the earliest scientists in the Western tradition. And here is how Empedocles described God. He said, "The divine isn't something you can see with your eyes or hold in your hands. It doesn't have a face or feet or gender, but is pure consciousness whose awareness extends throughout the entire cosmos. It is nothing but consciousness in every direction and eternally rejoices in the encircling silence." Now, Paul, today we call this Eastern philosophy. 2,500 years ago, this was Western philosophy.
Right, I was going to say, it sounds almost like something you'd hear from an Indian guru, you know. It's very similar, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it's astonishing. Did you know that, I didn't know, that Alexander the Great had a guru? I watched numerous TV shows and, I read all kinds of articles about Alexander the Great. But until I went back to the ancient Greek sources themselves, because he had, the equivalent of reporters who traveled with him, recording, everything he was doing as he was traveling across the old world, conquering the world. But I never heard, until I read the ancient Greek sources themselves, that virtually the first thing he did when he got to India was he sent out a reconnaissance team to find out one of these yogis that he's been hearing so much about.
And go ahead.
Well, and so he actually, his first encounter with a yogi named Danda is very, very famous and is recorded in several ancient sources. But he actually found a guru named Kalyana who he took back to Persia with him.
Fascinating stuff. You know, I think we have such a simplistic understanding of history, and some of it is because of Hollywood. You know, we have these stereotypes. Alexander is a warrior, so therefore all he's interested in is, conquering and destroying and everything. We forget that there's levels and levels to a person. I remember reading once about Attila the Hun. You know, the common understanding of Attila the Hun is that he was, a total reprobate, a pagan, etc., out to destroy Rome, and living in tents. And actually, he lived in a huge, huge tent that looked like a palace, and read books and was well read and educated, very sophisticated, and total opposite of this modern, stereotype we have about him. And I think that's unfortunate, really, because life is much more fascinating and subtle than some of these stereotypes. And we've got it today, don't we? We've got these stereotypes of, all Muslims are a certain way, and it's a sad thing, really, because there's always more going on than meets the eye, I think. And so I'm glad you're writing this book to bring some of that understanding to us, that there's a whole, and I keep bringing up that word, holism, but that seems to be a common thread for me in reading this book. Folks, I'm with a wonderful lady named Linda Johnson, and that's with an E if you're looking for the book, Linda Johnson.
Linda Johnson.
Yeah, and it's pronounced Johnson. All right, Johnson. So we're up in Scandinavia now,
yes,
Scandinavian
yes.
origins. Very good. And we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to cycle back to Orpheus, because on page 19 and 20 of this book is a fantastic exegesis, which is a fancy word for interpretation of some actions by the Titans that seem horrific, but really, if you understand them from a symbolic or spiritual perspective, they make perfect sense. And it's a wonderful explication of that. So join us in a couple of minutes after these messages from Unity.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
Available, YouPray, the free prayer app from Silent Unity. For more than a century, people from all over the world and all walks of life have turned to Silent Unity. With YouPray, our confidential prayer support is easy and convenient to access. With YouPray, you can send your prayer directly to Silent Unity. YouPray also includes affirmations you can share with family and friends, plus audio meditations for your prayer time. For more about the free YouPray app and links to download, visit silentunity.org/app. That's silentunity.org/app.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. Linda Johnson here, or Johnson. Is here to talk about her book, Lost Masters, Discovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. And we were drilling down a little bit into the mythology around Dionysus and his destruction by the Titans, tore him apart and ate him. And if you've ever seen the black paintings of Goya. If you've ever gone to the Prado in Spain, you'll see that famous painting of one of the titans eating this little boy, and it's one of the most frightening pictures you can come across, I think. And I always was sort of shocked by it and think, what's all that about, you know? But you explain it in a very beautiful way. Do you want to talk about it a little bit?
Dionysus was a divine child. He was one of Zeus's children by Semele. And the Titans were jealous of his divinity and his beauty. And so they actually ripped him into pieces. Now, this at one level, you know, Semele means the moon. And at one level, it does mean, you know, the light leaching out of the moon, you know, night by night as during the waning phase of the moon. But it also has a profound spiritual meaning. When the Titans attacked him, they gave him a mirror. They gave him a little mirror to play in because he was a small child. And this is just like Quetzalcoatl, the same thing in the Mayan tradition. You know, this divine being looks into a mirror and loses himself. He becomes vulnerable because he's looking at his reflection instead of at the reality. When consciousness peers into the mirror of matter and sees its loveliness reflected back, it reflects its real nature. I'm actually giving a course on Satya philosophy of India in a couple of weeks, and this is one of the central points in Indian philosophy also. It's the exact same thing. So when you forget your real nature, you become vulnerable to these titanic forces, these forces of nature, that shred the one spirit, you know, into a vast number of souls. So nature swallows consciousness. And then suddenly, instead of being this vast unified field of consciousness that according to the tradition, we were originally, before the beginning of manifestation, were swallowed up into nature. And we begin thinking of ourselves as individual souls who identify with our bodies. In the myth, Athena is able to restore this Dionysus. And when we embrace the wisdom of these traditions, you know, when we're meditating on our innermost self, then our unity with divine being is restored. And so there's still this connection of Dionysus with ecstasy. But it's the ecstasy of cosmic consciousness. Now there's all kinds of connections with India here, because as some of you may know, the another name for Dionysus was actually Bhagha. And that is was also his name in India, where they had very much the same sort of cult or tradition of just divine ecstasy. And so it really is fascinating, all these connections.
Let me just follow up with that by reading two paragraphs here that you've written, because I think they're very beautiful. It's you write, when consciousness peers into the mirror of matter and sees its own loveliness reflected back, it forgets its real nature.
Right.
It's involved in the illusory nature of things. Now it becomes vulnerable to the Titans, you know, which I would describe as those forces subject to sickness, old age, and death, who shred the one spirit into a vast number of souls. Nature swallows consciousness and mortality. The union of undying spirit with a perishable body flickers into existence. So it's got some kind of dualism arising there.
Correct.
The oceanic field of unified consciousness now appears as an infinite number of individual souls caught in physical bodies. Athena, divine wisdom within us, obviously, is able to restore the lost state of unity by embracing wisdom, meditating on our innermost heart. Our unity with divine being is restored, and Dionysus is the ecstasy of cosmic consciousness, not physical intoxication. This reminds me of Shiva as well, the Shiva consciousness.
Correct, exactly.
This state is accessible to those who withdraw from their titanic or earthly nature And we build our earthly nature out of proportion, you know, in that titanic form. Our ego becomes out of control and reclaim their divine heritage. And, of course, it's ironic, isn't it? The greatest ship that was ever floated on the water that could never be sunk was right. The Titanic, you know, and right. It went down with an iceberg. So it's a kind of hubris, isn't it? When we set ourselves up as these ego beings, there's a great pride before the fall, as they say.
Exactly correct.
Fascinating stuff.
It's an amazing tradition, and it's amazing that so many of the root concepts are almost identical in traditions ranging from the Druids all the way to Bengal in eastern India. Many traditions say very, very similar things.
So you know, when you read it literally, you think, oh, you know, how silly these people were entertaining themselves with outrageous, you know, stories, the worst kind of action movies, you know, of Hollywood. But when you understand the what it's really saying, what this, you know, spiritual and archetypal meanings are to these stories, you say, oh yeah, of course, you know, this makes perfect sense, doesn't it? It's the way the forces of the universe and the forces of our own psyches and our own being, you know, interact and come back eventually to the one, right? To the whole. You've talked about Empedocles. I remember reading a poem by Matthew Arnold called Empedocles on Etna. I think he wrote a long dramatic poem, and of course Empedocles eventually jumps into the crater, doesn't he? That's how he dies.
Yes, he goes to the top of Mount Etna with his disciples, and they return down, and he says, oh, I'll come later. But he never appears. Instead, they see these tremendous flashes of light there in the night. So in the morning, they go up, and all they find are his sandals right by the rim of the crater. And it's one of the most fantastic scenes to visualize from ancient Greece. The great scientist and philosopher Empedocles just leaping into the mountain, leaping into the volcano.
And it reminds me of other, you know, stories from the Eastern tradition, you know, of gurus who either walk off into the sunset, never to be seen again, or you've got an example of one of them walking into the fire, into a funeral pyre. You know, and even in modern times, we see monks immolate themselves, you know, in fire and sit in meditation until they keel over dead. Total disregard for or overcoming of the seeming limits of our physical selves, right, to demonstrate that it's something higher, nothing to be feared.
The yogi that you're referring to, who walked into the fire, who I talk about in my book, that was Alexander the Great's guru, Kalyana. Kalyana accompanied Alexander and his army back into Persia. But Kalyana was really disgusted with the Greeks. And Alexander, as you can imagine, he was an intelligent guy, but he was also, by that time, just a raving alcoholic. And, you know, homicidal, he was dangerous. And, in fact, his men assassinated him later, apparently. But Kalyana decided he wanted to go back to India. But to walk all that way back in his aging body, that was too much trouble. So he decided to just leave his body there and go back the old-fashioned way, you know, in spirit. And so they say what he did. Alexander heaped all kinds of wealth on him. And he took all these things, which he didn't want anyway, and just distributed them to the people there. And then he had a funeral pyre built, and he just went and sat down in it and left his body there and let it burn. And the thing was, the Greek army was standing there watching this, and this, like, galvanized the Greeks. They could not believe that someone could be so completely beyond pain and fear that at the time of death they would just, you know, perform their own cremation. So these stories about the wisdom and the dispassion of the yogis filtered back to the Greeks. And so, for example, that's why Plotinus, who you and I both agree was the greatest Greek thinker of all, he actually tried to get to India because he'd been hearing about this. Unfortunately for him, he was stopped in Persia and forced to return, but that was very fortunate for the Western world because he went back to Rome and started one of the greatest philosophical traditions in world history. But let me actually, if you don't mind, let me tell you about Apollonius of Tyana, because he's one of the Greeks, like Pyrrho and Anaxarchus, and who traveled with Alexander. But Apollonius was one of the ones who did get to India. Now, he lived in the 1st century A.D., and to me, kind of rather surprisingly, Jesus, who is a saint that we associate with the 1st century A.D., but he was really not that well known during his lifetime. The most famous sage in the 1st century was Roman Empire was Apollonius of Tyana. And he actually traveled to India and studied in a Hindu ashram. And everywhere he went after that, Greece, Rome, Spain, Turkey, North Africa, he would tell people about the yogis, who he said were the wisest, most amazing human beings he'd ever met. And he actually went to Egypt, too, afterwards, because to the ancient Greeks and Romans, the two great spiritual cultures were Egypt and India. So Apollonius also went to Egypt, but by that time that tradition was beginning to decline. Apollonius just noticed the incredible similarity between the Egyptians' esoteric doctrines and practices and those that he had already learned in India. He was so blown away by that that he actually offered this fascinating theory that in vast antiquity, a group of teachers from India must have migrated to North Africa and taught this stuff to the Egyptians. Now, I am not saying that that's actually historically true, but it's very interesting that Apollonius, who was very familiar with the Indian tradition and with the Egyptian tradition, found these astonishing connections. In the ancient Greek material, Egyptian material, we actually find this myth, or maybe it's not a myth, I don't know, that Osiris, the great Egyptian god king, actually went to India. I mean, I fell out of my chair when I read that. There are numbers of links between India and Egypt that are almost inexplicable and are truly, truly remarkable. You know, and just to underscore, you know, Pythagoras, Plato, Plotinus, Democritus, Apollonius, many of the greatest minds of ancient Greece studied in Egypt. And in fact, one of the things that I do in my book, there are these just amazing, amazing, amazing texts called the Corpus Hermeticum. In my opinion, the greatest spiritual text in the Western tradition, with the possible exception of Plotinus's Aeneas. But these books meld together the ancient Egyptian and Greek wisdom traditions. And when the Corpus Hermeticum, when these texts were rediscovered in I think it was like 1460, something like that, they helped spark the European Renaissance. And so anyway, I have numbers of quotes from these texts in the book Lost Masters, and I promise you, it will blow your mind to see how close these Egyptian teachings are to the teachings of India. I'm inviting readers to explore their long-forgotten Western spiritual heritage. I'm telling you, this will challenge everything you thought you knew about the men and women who founded Western civilization. I mean, I was just so flabbergasted reading this material.
Well, you know, I think there's another common myth, and that is that, you know, everybody's stuck at a certain place and nobody knows anything about anywhere else. You know, I remember growing up thinking that the Romans you know, it pushed the levels of civilization to the edge of the known world, and then there was nothing really beyond. There was a vague understanding there was India somewhere, but basically it wasn't really important, you know. And that's a total misnomer, isn't it? Because, as you say, there are all these links, and if you see all the statuary in Afghanistan, you'll see that it's a blend between Chinese or Indian styles and Greek styles. You know, there was a whole civilization there in the Middle East and in the middle parts of what's now what was the former Soviet Union, of all these traditions. Another thing I found fascinating when I was younger, I visited a place in the Orkney Islands called Scarabray, and it's way up there in the north of Scotland, and it's a 3,000 or 4,000-year-old little township, and it was lost under a bunch of sand dunes, and in a great storm it was revealed, and then the archaeologists got to work. Well, they found the artifacts that had come all the way from the Middle East and Greece and Egypt to this place in the north of Scotland, you know. And I began to muse, you know, good Lord, there was a whole trade route, you know, from the Western Isles of Great Britain all the way to the Middle East, equally as long a distance as from the Middle East to India. So you know, it's very possible and probable, actually, that there was this interconnection of wisdom, right?
These were not easy journeys, but merchants were making these journeys all the time.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And I think what's been missed is, although we have all this archaeological evidence of all these goods trading back and forth, but it doesn't occur to people that ideas were trading back and forth as well. And you look at these ancient Greek sources, and then you find explicitly the Greek philosophers, they were studying with wise men and women of older spiritual cultures around them. Like they studied with the Magi from Persia, the Chaldeans from Iraq, as well as teachers from Egypt, as well in some cases even with teachers from India. I mean, it's really, really, it really opens your mind to how cosmopolitan people were in antiquity.
That's right, yeah. And here's the other side to that, just to play the devil's advocate for a second. You know, I think that some people say, oh, they must have studied there because they wouldn't have got the ideas, you know, otherwise. And
no.
I counter that by saying that, you know, once you penetrate into consciousness, you can find understanding that's incredibly similar to understanding in another part of the planet, because we're all one, in essence. You know, we are part of the divine.
You're absolutely correct. And I don't want to create the impression that I'm saying, you know, the Greeks learned everything from India, just as the scholars were trying to say, well, the Indians learned everything from Greece, which is ridiculous. Anyone who's doing meditative practices, they're going to have very similar experiences and similar insights. They are communicating with each other and hearing about each other, but the point is they're all doing their spiritual work. And someone like Plotinus, he's not writing about India. He's following his tradition back to Plato, and Plato doesn't name his sources, but he says that he studied, you know, with teachers who represented ancient traditions. And Plato, of course, was in Egypt. He was learning from the Orphics, he was learning from the Egyptians. But you know, this is one world tradition, actually.
Yes.
And most of us have already heard, you know, the yoga and meditation techniques from India, or about Sufism or the Kabbalah. But what we don't know about is our own Western spiritual heritage. We don't even know it existed. I mean, it's just such a shame that we've lost this. We've lost our connection with our own sages.
And, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that we have as our main source book, you know, and I'm not putting the Bible down, I use it extensively myself.
Yeah.
We have as our main source book a book that's outside our own ethnic traditions for most of us in the West, you know, from the Middle East, from Semitic cultures. And that's great because we're all linked together. But we have, like you say, our own great tradition as well that you know, it's been railroaded aside. We only look at it in a certain way rather than in a full way of inspiration. And but now I think in the modern era, you know, with the diaspora of Tibetans and bringing their texts and their tradition and their spirituality to the West, and the huge influx of you know, Eastern ideas into the West, that this is all breaking down now. You know, that the things that would have been very esoteric a few years ago and now commonly available, and there's no reason why that can't be the same case for a greater understanding of the Greek tradition, right?
Let me address what you were just saying. People forget that there's something called the Indo-European tradition. Whether you're in Ireland at one end of the world and Bengal at the other, and Calcutta at the other end of the world, you've got this Indo-European tradition. Remember in Sanskrit, you know, the word for mother is matra, you know, brother, bruhitra, daughter, druhitra, you know, three, tree. And so on. We're speaking the same closely related languages. But I want to really hasten and jump in here to say that we're not discluding or leaving aside the Semitic traditions. Let me just mention Iamblichus, Iamblichu, his name was. He was from Syria, and he was Semitic. And he became one of the most important teachers in the Neoplatonic tradition, in fact, I would encourage anyone who's interested in astrology or magic rituals or tantra, you know, read the chapter in the book on Iamblichus. He had really good advice for people who are interested in channeling and contacting this kind of entities, whether you think of them as actually real or as projections of the unconscious. But he collected together as much as he could find of the wisdom of the Semitic traditions of Babylon and the Assyrians and the Chaldeans. And you'll see that this material, too, is just so much like the wisdom tradition of the Indo-Europeans. He talks about spiritual entities or energies, let's call them. And some are benign and others are not, and he explains how to tell the difference. He also warns how spiritual practice can shade over into sorcery when your ego gets involved, which is one of the things I really appreciate about Iamblichus. He says, real spiritual practice exalts the soul, not the ego, and is dedicated not for one's own personal benefit, but for the good of all. You know, just all these wonderful insights that are coming in also.
Right. Well, so much of our common wisdom tradition, even if it's subconscious, comes from a lot of the Greek thinkers, doesn't it? I'm thinking of Heraclitus, you know, one of my favorites. I was disappointed to learn in your book that he was kind of a mean-spirited person.
He was very unpopular.
Saw him as a very wise and calm person. You know, we could see that, you know, time and change really are illusions. Everything is changed, but the more it changes, the more it's still the same, as the French put it, I think. You know, this idea, you can't step into the same river twice, and yet the river goes on, you know, eternally. So that changelessness in the midst of change. But he wasn't a nice guy, huh?
We're hearing this from his detractors. He taught things that were that made people uncomfortable, like war is king, and that there is a role for like strife and things people would consider evil, that these also have a role in nature, because nature becomes unbalanced if you don't have predators and so on. But he was a brilliant, brilliant man, almost certainly deeply influenced by Persian thinkers. Heraclitus, he was extraordinary, actually. And following in his tradition later, you had the Stoics, who were also brilliant. You know, they recognized that the universe was billions of years old, that it comes and goes in cycles, And these were brilliant and great minds who recognized, you know, geological eras and cosmic eras really just remarkable thinkers.
So, you know, there's this great divide, isn't there, between Plato and Aristotle, supposedly, right? And based on some valid understanding of their different views of things. But really, it's false, isn't it? Because it's not easy just to say, well, one was, you know, interested in these idealized forms, and the other one was interested in the material forms, which is the sort of common popularized understanding. How would you approach that?
Yes, today when we read Plato and then we read Aristotle, we get this idea of two completely different focuses. You know, Plato's being much more spiritual but the thing is that the ancient in the school, in the Platonic school, they did not think of Aristotle and Plato as being, you know, one is worldly and the other is spiritual. They saw their teachers as complementing each other.
Yes.
And they taught both of them in their schools. So Plotinus, you know, our favorite, you know, he was a great devotee of Plato's work, but he also uses Aristotelian arguments and explanations in his texts. You know, we see them as opposed now, but they were not seen as opposed in antiquity. They were just covering different aspects of reality.
Yes. Well, and that's one thing I love about Hinduism in general is the ability to bring seeming opposites together, you know, and there's nothing that can't be taken on board in Hinduism, right? The very idea of the twin ideas of Shiva, Shakti, you know, complementing each other,
right?
And you know, the fact that goddesses given their due, you know, whereas of course that was true in ancient Greek tradition too, but it's been sort of exiled. We tried to maintain a sort of a female idea, you know, in Catholicism with Mary, but not to the extent, not to the sophisticated extent, I think the Hindus understand that. And I love that bringing things together, you know, that seemingly
right.
are disparate. Yeah.
If there are any listeners out there who are really interested in the goddess tradition, I'm actually an initiate in the Shakti Dvaita, in the goddess tradition in India, and I wrote a book called The Living Goddess. So that's The Living Goddess by Linda Johnson, and it will really introduce you to, you know, people think the goddess tradition is just about fertility and growing crops and having babies, which is part of it, but there's much, much, much more to the yogic science of Shaktism, of the goddess tradition. And if you should be interested in that, check out my book, The Living Goddess.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
It's marvelous.
And I remember I visited an ashram in Wales quite often when I can, when I'm over there. And one of the temples is dedicated to Mahashakti. And many years I resisted it for some reason. You know, I didn't. I was frightened by it. But now I understand. Of course, you know, the Kali tradition, you know, of the bright red tongue and all the bodies flying through space and the necklaces of skulls and all that and the cudgels, and it seems intimidating initially, but then you understand that it's simply a representation of the swirling nature of existence, you know.
Exactly.
The mother cares for everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, you understand that it's not to be feared, but to integrate all those things, not to run from sickness, old age, and death, but to understand that's part and parcel of the beauty of being alive.
Correct.
I can't believe we're already at the end of the show. It's
I know.
It's rushed by, isn't it? It's fascinating stuff. Folks, well, if you want to get hold of this book, it's published by one of my favorite publishing houses, New World Library. Of course, it's available in all the usual outlets, and you'll find Linda's work available. Like we said, she's written many books. If people want to get in touch with you, do you have a website?
You can go to Lost Masters, LostMasters.com.
There we go, LostMasters.com, and check this out. There's some fascinating things. You'll come across old favorites, but you also discover new understanding, and even the old favorites you'll find are portrayed in a startlingly different light. So a lot of fascinating stuff in here, very well written, engagingly written, and obviously Linda has a deep, subtle perception of Hindu spirituality, and so when she brings it in, it's very thoughtfully presented. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Linda. Next week, for a change of pace, I welcome Lisa Loving Dalton, who's going to share about her life as a stunt woman on the East and West Coasts and in Hollywood. Her book, Falling for the Stars, A Stunt Woman's Tattletales, is a fascinating read about fame, disillusionment, illness, actually, as a result of an accident, and eventually transformation. So she'll share with me next week on next week's show to join me then. But right now, we want to give a hearty thank you to Linda for being with us and sharing about your fascinating studies. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Paul.
And have a safe week, everyone. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org. Like life, grief is a journey, not a destination. Whether it is loss of life, relationship, security, or simply the process of change, have you given yourself permission to begin your journey of grief? Have you yielded to the gift of grace? Join Reverend Chaz Wesley every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central on a virtual navigation from grief to grace, and explore new horizons of empowerment, significance, and support. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
I'll light a candle in your name.
Dorothy Day, a co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement in America, called for not a revolution of arms, but a revolution of the heart. Since the beginning of our nation, the American Revolutionary War, and long before that, actually, there's not been a time without conflict somewhere in the world. Makes you stop and think, doesn't it? Certainly we live in challenging times. Each day brings seemingly limitless opportunities to take offense. And each opportunity offers me a choice. I can give a knee-jerk response in fear or anger, or I can choose consciously to respond in love. My choice may seem insignificant. After all, I'm only one person. But as history has taught us, one person can make a difference. Peace can begin with me.
To find a Unity Church near you, please visit our website at www.unity.org.
Have you ever considered that everything you think, say, and do is a prayer to the universe? What would your life be like if you activated the power of yes? Join Reverend Beverly Molander and her exciting guests on Affirmative Prayer, Activating the Power of Yes, to find out how they activated the power of yes in their lives, their communities, or even the world. If they can do it, you can too. Listen to Beverly Molander and her guests live every Monday at noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, on Affirmative Prayer, Activating the Power of Yes. Only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.